Today is Marion McFeeter's final day as the director of the Lyceum program. And she's been doing this for at least 10 years to our great benefit at Kendall. And I think we should take note of it and thank her for everything. I thought maybe Marion would like to say something. But we're all greatly in your debt, Marion. When Marion asked me to speak, I thought I could talk about the campus unrest of the 60s and 70s in a disinterested, objective manner, but it's not turned out that way. It's become a highly personal statement built around what I saw and what I did during those difficult days. Since I was the de facto crisis manager during much of the 6 years I was provost, which is the number two position in the university, and the de jure manager during the 8 years I was president, perhaps it was inevitable that it would turn out to be about me and what I did. I make no claim to have done it right. There were many things I would do differently if I were in a position to do it again, but I don't want to be ever in that position. I was simply the person who was there, sitting at the same desk, doing more or less the same thing for 14 years. The chair I sat in became necessarily the hot seat. Student revolts the world over, protesting situations perceived as unjust are common, but the degree of protest and the extent of the protests reached historic levels in the 1960s and 70s. Each country and each campus had its own issues. At Cornell, the protests were largely about civil rights and the Vietnam War. All American students were vulnerable then. Black students had lived all their lives against a backdrop of lynchings and Jim Crowism. All students lived under the threatening crowd of the draft. They were being asked to put their lives on the line for a cause they did not support. 58,000 young people paid the ultimate price. In other countries, young people were jousting with repressive governments, poverty, and social injustice. They struck out at authority, wherever it might be. The protests were worldwide. We read in the newspapers about French students blockading Paris streets. When my wife, Nellie, and I went to see the University of Tokyo in a 1968 visit to Tokyo, to Japan, we discovered that the university had been closed for months. I traveled to South America frequently in the 60s, and I watched the intense protests, particularly at San Marcos University in Lima, Peru, the oldest university in the Western Hemisphere, and at the University of Buenos Aires in Argentina. I believed that such things could not happen here. Some protests continued longer in other countries than they did here. The biggest trouble of all was the Tiananmen Square massacre in Beijing in 1989, A decade and a half after our campuses became relatively quiet, I knew the Chinese situation well from my advisory role in the administration of a large World Bank loan to strengthen Chinese universities. 46 students died that night in the square, and hundreds of others in surrounding neighborhoods. In watching a TV program a day or two later, I saw soldiers in the back of a truck open fire on bicyclists and pedestrians on the sidewalk in front of the Beijing Hotel, where I had stayed a few times in the preceding 7 years. In December 1964, the free speech movement at the University of California at Berkeley hit American newspapers and news broadcasts. The trigger event at Berkeley was the refusal of the university administration to let students distribute protest literature at a prominent place on the edge of the campus. A student leader named Mario Savio organized a takeover of the university administration building. The students marched in singing, led by Joan Baez, whose father was a professor of physics at Stanford. Ed Meese, later Reagan's attorney general, was the district attorney of Alameda County, and he came on the campus with an army of police who carried the students out of the building, four police on each student. It was not a pretty sight. American protests took many forms. There were rallies, large gatherings of students, often outdoors, discussing their issues with public address systems or bullhorns. There were often marches, usually to a rally somewhere. In Ithaca, there were marches downtown to DeWitt Park near the Presbyterian and Baptist churches where speakers addressed the assembled crowd. Occupying the president's office was a common tactic. Occupying a whole building was sometimes the tactic. Student strikes closed some campuses. Sometimes the events turned violent and there were fatalities. There were four fatalities at one of the traditional black colleges at Spartanburg, South Carolina. There were two at UCLA, two at Stanford, two at the University of Kansas, one at Wisconsin, and there was Kent State, where four people died. Fortunately, there were no fatalities at Cornell. The first Cornell protest of this era was in March 1965 by a group of students who called themselves Students for Education. The last was an occupation of my office in April 1976, 11 years later, by a group of black students protesting the dismissal of a black student employee for failure to perform his duties. What I tell you about today is a sample of what transpired during those 11 troublesome years. There were many, many more protest events. The Students for Education sought to correct what they saw as deficiencies in Cornell undergraduate education, such as the use of teaching assistants with an inadequate command of English. They staged a rally one night in March 1965. I was provost of the university at the time, and the president was James Perkins, who had come to Cornell from the Carnegie Foundation a couple of years earlier. On the morning after the rally, President Perkins came into my office about 8 o'clock, threw down the Cornell Sun with its large headlines about the rally and said, "This is your problem. I'm going to New York." By pure coincidence, the rally was the day before the opening of a gala Cornell centennial celebration in New York City at Lincoln Center. This gala celebration included the premier performance of a symphony composed by one of the Cornell Music faculty on a commission from the New York Philharmonic. Other events followed on subsequent days. So here I was, early on a March morning, with a budding student revolt on my hands and no experience in or qualifications for managing such a disruption. I was the wrong person in the wrong place at the wrong time. I sat there for perhaps 20 or 30 minutes asking myself how to proceed. Should I ignore the whole affair and go about my business? Should I get involved to try to learn what the issues were and what might be done about them? The president of the University of California system was Clark Kerr, a man who was already a leading spokesman for higher education, but he had developed something of a negative reputation by staying away from the campus during the few months since the free speech movement took root. I decided I had to get involved, so I gave my secretary the names of four or five students identified by the Sun as the leaders of the rally and told her I wanted them in my office by 10 o'clock. By some miracle, she got every one of them. I had the dean of students and the dean of faculty with me. The practice of getting to know the performers was one I followed for the entire 11 years of the Troubles. The first hour of discussion was confrontational. The second hour began to identify issues. The third hour developed a guide to an agenda we proposed to guide the activity with for the remainder of the semester. We pursued that agenda for the remainder of the semester, and at the end of the semester, four of the students, two women and two men, invited Nellie and me to dinner one evening at a student apartment in College Town, and it was a fine dinner. I've since learned that we surprised them by accepting their invitation. The young woman who was the chef that evening is now the dean of the law school and the executive vice president of Georgetown University. She served 1 5-year term as a Cornell trustee. I met one of the men quite by chance in Washington once and learned that he was an official in one of the big political polling organizations. During the protest years, many people were involved on the university side, and many of the policies adopted were the work of many people. During the period, I had the help of Keith Kennedy in some of the events, particularly those having to do with minority students and civil rights issues. I had learned long before that I would profit by Keith's help wherever I could get it. The protest kettle came to a boil, and along the way, there was one event that would have been amusing, except in the skirmishing, the head of the campus police was fired, not by me, but by someone else with administrative authority. This was the Trojan horse episode. The Trojan horse was a student literary magazine, and in one issue, the chief of campus police believed a piece of faction was pornographic and that he had the right and the duty to confiscate it and so prevent any circulation on the campus. Then the district attorney entered the fray by coming on the campus with the Ithaca police. Students surrounded the police cars so they could not move and let the air out of the tires. The campus exploded over confiscation of the magazines, and the faculty stormed my office demanding action to return free speech. When it was all over, I consulted the local Supreme Court judge, whom I knew, and thus discussed with him how to deal with such situations. He was quite relaxed about the whole affair, somewhat amused, and believed that a little experience was a good thing for the DA. I then sought out the DA. I did not have to tell him that his tactics had not worked. We discussed the campus ethos and the reasons for the emphasis on free speech. He has since told me that those discussions had been a valuable part of his education. Whenever I'm at a reception where he's present and there's a pay-as-you-go bar, he buys me a martini. The most tragic event during my time in office was a fire having nothing to do with protests in an off-campus residential unit in which 9 people died. It was an arson case, and its origin in a bottom floor lounge was easily established. The deaths came from breathing toxic fumes created by burning plastic sofa covers. I did not arrive on the scene until the fire was extinguished, but the bodies were still scattered where the people were overcome. One of the victims was a young faculty member who, with his wife, had house sat our house one summer while we were away. Another victim was a student from Finland. Before that day was over, I had talked to the Finnish ambassador twice and to 2 other embassy officials once each. Many diplomatic protocols and international legalities were involved. One of the heroes of the residential fire was Dr. Henry Humphrey, our fellow Kendall resident who lived near the building that burned. He saved at least one life and was almost overcome himself. It seemed to be my misfortune for the president to be out of town at times of crisis, and I was left to pick up the pieces. That was the case with the fire. The president was attending a conference in Paris. By 1968, it was evident that we were going to have ongoing protests, and I made it my business to get to know all the community police forces. My object was to negotiate an agreement with them under which we would try to contain whatever developed with our own campus police, but if events got out of hand, we would call them. They would come on the campus only if called. I talked to the mayor of Ithaca, the district attorney, the police chiefs of Cayuga Heights and Ithaca, and the sheriff, and received the assurances I sought. My birthday is April 5th, and some of the unhappiest events clustered around that date. The residential club fire was on April 5, 1967. On April 4, 1968, we had the Economics 103 affair. Economics 103 was a course taught by a visiting professor. Some of the black students alleged that he made racist remarks in his lectures And they occupied the Economics Department office to protest the statements. The office had two parts, an outer part where the secretary had her desk and an inner office for the department chairman. I went to the scene, taking the dean of the faculty with me. The outer office was filled with black students and the inner office by three or four students and the department chairman. There had already been an unfortunate incident. Our campus police carried no guns, except on bank runs where they were transporting money for deposit in the bank. Otherwise, they were unarmed. In this case, they had been called to the scene just after finishing a bank run. We had sometimes used the tactic of letting protesters leave the scene of the protest, but not allowing re-entry. We invoked that tactic here. The police sought to prevent one of the students from returning to the economics office, and the student threw the policeman to the floor. This dislodged the gun and it fell free. That inflamed the whole situation to a high level, just in time for my arrival on the scene. I never wanted the police to interfere with any discussion I was having with students, and I asked them to retire to a lower floor of the building. The discussion about racism in teaching economics lasted most of the afternoon without much progress toward clarification of issues. It's interesting to look at the academic performance of some of the students who were the leaders in raising civil rights issues to the protest level. There was a widely held view that we were admitting unqualified minority students. The leader of the Economics 103 confrontation was an engineering student carrying 18 hours of engineering courses with an A- or B+ average. He was always in competition for leadership of black students with another student who had been president of his entire freshman class. After graduating from Cornell, the latter worked his way up the corporate ladder to become president of TIAACREF, the organization that controls academic pensions. And he then joined the Citibank group, where he was the third or fourth ranking executive in what I believe is the largest financial institution in the world. The Economics 103 leader left Cornell early in the spring of 1969. He later went to medical school and became an ophthalmologist. He died from some rare disease. When James Perkins came as president to Cornell in 1963, the number of black undergraduates was something like 7. A number representative of the fraction of blacks in the total population would have been more like 2,000. President Perkins looked at this failure to serve the needs of the country and decided that we had to have a program of some type to attract able students, such as the Economics 103 leader and the former president of the freshman class, and give them an opportunity for a Cornell education. Unfortunately, we did not fully realize the great pressure such a small group would experience in the world of white faces they encountered here. We committed ourselves to creating a black study center where any student, but especially the minority students, could learn about the black heritage and explore problems in that heritage that needed study. The center has long been called the Africana Study Center. Throughout this period of the late 60s and early 70s, we were beset by a continuous sequence of confrontations of one kind or another. There were attempts to prevent the military or other governmental services from recruiting on campus. There were attempts to prevent corporations that did business in South Africa from recruiting. There were attempts to abolish ROTC. One of our biggest problems was guaranteeing speakers who came to the campus the right to say what they had come to say. The first person who was severely heckled was Avril Harriman, former governor of New York and the person who guided the negotiation of the nuclear test ban treaty in the early 1970s. Another was Dean Rusk, who when he was Secretary of State in the early Vietnam War days, came to speak in Bailey Hall. A group that did its best to make life complicated for me and for others was the SDS, Students for a Democratic Society. This was a white organization. The leader of the Cornell chapter was a student who came to Cornell expecting to pursue a military career as his father had. After a few years as a militant leftist, he turned so far right it was painful. I see him frequently these days, and I exchanged emails with him only about 6 weeks ago. He teaches in a community college in Los Angeles. Coming back to April 4, 1968, I went directly from the discussion of alleged racism in teaching economics to the Statler to have dinner with the candidate of choice to be the next dean of the College of Home Economics. When I left that dinner, I learned that Martin Luther King had been assassinated. The next day, April 5, 1968, was a day of turmoil on the campus. I will say little about this sad day. The loss of Martin Luther King was a terrible loss for everyone, regardless of color. In 1968, a particularly militant group of black students gained control of the student organization representing them. I believe they called it the Black Liberation Front. They seized an off-campus house where an academic department had its headquarters. The students demanded a place to house the Africana Studies Center, and we were in the process of creating. And this off-campus building was their choice of a home. They occupied the house, forcing the occupants out, and placed a notice on the door saying that the building was now theirs. It was ironic that I had been working to relocate the people there to make the building available to the Africana Center. The students knew about this effort, but they apparently wanted the world to think they were in charge. Keith Kennedy completed the relocation and the Africana Center moved in. The black student leader called President Perkins at home, where he was in bed with the flu, to order him to appear in the house at a specified hour. Mrs. Perkins answered the phone and told the student that the president was going nowhere, and furthermore, she told him what she thought of him. She called me immediately to tell me what she'd done, and as soon as she freed the line, a very angry black student called to tell me what had happened and ordered me to appear at the designated time. I agreed to go, and an involved faculty member went with me. At that time, we had a 6'4", 6'5", 230-pound black athlete named Harry Edwards as a student. He had been the organizer of the partially successful black boycott of the Mexico City Olympics some months earlier. He did not generally participate in the negotiations about American activities, but he was present at this particular meeting. They placed him between me and the door to make sure I didn't escape, something I had no intention of trying. In more recent times, Harry Edwards has been a professor of sociology at the University of California at Berkeley, and has sometimes appeared as a negotiator in professional athlete labor disputes. At the meeting in the Africana House, the faculty member and I were seated before perhaps 50 angry black students. The campus police were present, but I asked them to stay in the background. The purpose of the meeting was to tell us exactly what we were going to do to create the Africana Center and how much money they were going to have to operate things themselves. What they proposed was not quite what we had in mind, but we listened. There was little discussion. They told us who was acceptable and who was not for the directorship of the Africana program. In the end, we organized the center on our terms with the leader we selected and with the amount of money we had specified. I believe the center opened its doors in the fall of 1969. During those days, there were black students who came to tell me what was going on and their estimate of how it might play out. The campus police chief also had his informants in the group. At one point, and I don't exactly remember when, the Black Liberation Front had a meeting to decide on some radical move that would have been unfortunate from my viewpoint. One of the students told me about the meeting and stated his intent to attend and then report to me what I should be prepared for. The student went to the meeting, was completely turned off by the discussion, and left in disgust before any decision was reached. So my intelligence was about as useful as the intelligence on weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. A student I was particularly attracted to was the product of the inner city. I came to know him, and he sometimes came to talk to me about the issues that concerned the minority students. One time he came for such a discussion, and some of his fellow students learned about his visit and gave him a very hard time, presumably for consorting with the enemy. I learned that he was the oldest of what I remember as 7 children in a one-parent family. I once wrote a letter to help him get a part-time job downtown. I learned later that he was sending his earnings home to his mother. He finally found his burdens overwhelming, dropped out of school, and joined the army. He died in a training accident. Over the 68-69 mid-year holidays, we took stock, regrouped, and prepared ourselves for coming troubles in the late winter of 68-69, a period I consider the most dangerous in all of our unrest history. The troubles began with a symposium on South Africa in February of 69. On the first day, I presided at a lecture on apartheid by a black South African cleric. He was heckled mercilessly by a student I knew. I stopped the lecture, told the student that he was going to let the speaker finish what he had to say, or the student was going to be evicted from the room. The speaker was able to finish. The climax came a couple of days later when President Perkins was pulled from the podium and the microphone by a black student who had been the cause of growing concern over the previous few months. I had a black secretary, and the student sometimes came to my office and harangued the secretary about what he said I had to do. After the episode with the president, I came to believe that the student was capable of anything. Fortunately, he withdrew from the university before anything more serious developed. Tensions grew through the spring of 1969 and reached the climax in mid-April when black students occupied Willard Straight Hall, the student union building, during Parents' Weekend, ejected the parents occupying the hotel-type rooms, and then, hours later, introduced guns into the building. I'm not going to say much about this, as I've mentioned. I could not relate a true story of events as I knew them without implicating some of the students in despicable behavior and impugning the integrity of some day hall staff. I've written some about this event, and those statements are embargoed for another 20 years. A Cornell alumnus named Downs, who was an undergraduate in 1969 and is now a faculty member at the University of Wisconsin, wrote a book called Cornell 69 about the whole Willard Straight affair. He did an excellent job of digging out the factual history of the event, but he drew conclusions I do not agree with. I know more of the motives and intent of the occupation than he discovered. A number of participants in the Straight occupation, I have this a little bit out of order here, but please forgive me. A number of participants in the Straight occupation have had distinguished careers and are very able people. The leader of the takeover was a student I mentioned earlier with a career that led right to the top of the Citibank organization. Another from that time was a U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of New York. Another was a partner in a huge law firm. One earned his doctorate in education and has had a distinguished career in educational testing. He's returned to the campus twice in the last couple of years, and I've spent time with him on both occasions. I had lunch with him here at Kendall about 6 weeks ago. The Vice Provost for Diversity at Cornell and the Director of the Africana Center are organizing a lecture program to bring some of the black alumni back to the campus to talk about their experiences. I believe the program will begin next fall. Many years ago, I spent an hour or two with the former wife of the Straight occupation leader. The whole takeover had been planned in their living room in the married student housing area. I asked her, why the guns? She said the black students were being told that there was a conspiracy to round up black people in the North and imprison them in some big holding facility, and they were preparing to resist that. I think the immediate motivation for taking the guns into the Strait was a rumor that they were about to be attacked by fraternity members. On Monday, following the Sunday withdrawal of the students from the Strait, the campus was tense almost to the breaking point. I called the supervisor of the state police in Albany to ask if the state police would be available if we needed them. He replied, "Just call me, and you will see more state police than you've ever seen in your life, and you will see them in 15 minutes. A large group of deputy sheriffs from neighboring counties was assembled downtown. I never knew the number. I heard 200. We knew about the guns, incidentally, perhaps a week or 10 days before we began to get reports from gun dealers in this region telling us that Cornell students were buying guns and ammunition. We consulted the state police in Sydney, New York, and a detective, perhaps from the Bureau of Criminal Investigation, came to the campus and told us we had nothing to worry about. Guns were being bought up all over the north and were being shipped south. More weapons of mass destruction. The turmoil created by the guns and the Willard Strait event led to President Perkins' resignation and my installation as president. I took over on July 1, 1969, although I was not formally elected president until September. I was never inaugurated. There was an investiture ceremony at commencement a year later, a commencement accompanied by demonstrations and two attempts to take over the microphone. I was introduced by the chairman of the board as the eighth president of the United States. And that relieved the tension. President Perkins did not bear the responsibility for the campus disorders all by himself. None of us knew how to deal with the troubles. A whole generation of university presidents was sacrificed on the student protest altar. Cornell, Columbia, Duke, Stanford, Berkeley were examples. At Duke, the protesting students occupied the president's house when he was seriously ill. And I believe he was carried out through the crowd of occupying students to a waiting ambulance. At the University of Oregon, an acting president appeared to have died by his own hand on the day following commencement, 1969. The second generation of presidents had the benefit of on-the-job training during the misfortunes of their predecessors. We never had a student march on our home. One was planned for a Sunday afternoon, but it was a rainy day and the march was canceled. We always prayed for bad weather in the spring. One year, the biggest snow of the winter was on my April 5 birthday. That was a good year. In the early summer of 1969, after I had taken over the presidential duties, the executive staff held a two-day retreat at the Aurora Inn up the lake in Aurora, New York. We attempted to analyze our troubles and specify the steps that would get us headed back towards stability. We invented the Cornell Chronicle, a new campus judicial system. We installed a campus blue light telephone system where anyone could go to the nearest blue light and summon help or ask for an escort back to a dormitory. I met with every college and school faculty during that summer to discuss our problems and how we might deal with them. We installed a campus ombudsman office, and Liz Gordon was one of the operators there. We created a judicial advising system for students. We put in motion a plan for a constituent assembly to create a university senate with representatives of students in the senate. After a few years, people tired of it, and we dissolved the senate. The perpetrator. Detective work identified the place where the fire started and the accelerant used, but I never learned more. No one was injured in that fire. Beginning in the late 60s and extending into the 70s, militant black groups such as the Black Panthers were a force in civil rights struggles, and their influence reached into Northern University campuses. There was an FBI agent resident in Ithaca, and I knew him well. He considered it part of his job to keep me informed. One time, Bobby Seale, the Black Panther leader, was participating in some type of rally in New Haven, Connecticut, and police officials believed his next destination was Ithaca. I often, fortunately, he had some other destination in mind. I often knew things I thought I should not know, and I did not want to know. Sometimes, as in the Seale case, the intelligence was useful. I said nothing about drugs and alcohol to this point, but they presented problems during those years. I saw bright, attractive, able college students completely destroyed by drugs. One student on drugs walked out of his fraternity house and straight into Fall Creek Gorge to his death. There were times when some students wore boots with a knife thrust into the top of the boot. We feared that such a student high on drugs might become involved in some controversy and try to resolve matters with his knife. For a time, probably in the early 70s, a non-student spent his time sitting in Willard Strait Hall, the Student Union building. I knew from my FBI informant that the man had a prison record after conviction on a homicide charge. He was often high on drugs, and the longer the situation continued, the more concerned I became. I finally banned him from the campus. This led to severe criticism from some faculty members who pointed out that a university is one of the most open and accessible institutions in our society, and banning a person is intolerable. I stayed with the ban decision, and a few months later, the man in question killed another man in College Town over a drug deal. A disruption that had an occasional light moment was occupation of the Engineering College Library in Carpenter Hall by SDS students in the spring of 1972. I was attending a meeting of university presidents at Northwestern University in Chicago when Cornell students marched from a big rally in front of Willard Strait Hall down what is now Hope Plaza and up the hill, presumably to protest something on the upper campus. When the march passed Carpenter Hall, the marchers turned into the building and occupied the library before security forces could take any action. The students changed the doors closed, and access was only by ground level windows. My meeting at Northwestern had just finished a day and a half session and was breaking for lunch when I was called to the telephone to be told about Carpenter Hall. Derek Bach, president of Harvard, was called to the telephone at the same time to learn about a black student occupation of his office at Harvard. The night before, Nellie and I had gone to Milwaukee for an alumni dinner, and on the evening of the Carpenter Hall occupation, we were scheduled for an alumni dinner in Evanston, Illinois. We were staying with a Cornell trustee in Evanston, and I spent the afternoon at his house on the telephone with my colleagues in Ithaca. The following night, we were scheduled to attend an alumni dinner in Tucson, Arizona. 6 months earlier, I had accepted an invitation to speak at a dinner honoring the new president of the University of Arizona on the night following the Cornell dinner in Tucson. Our oldest son was a faculty member at Arizona, and we were looking forward to a relaxed weekend in Tucson. By the time of the Evanston dinner, my Ithaca colleagues and I had decided that I would attend the dinner and then return to Ithaca by a charter jet. Nellie would go on to Tucson and meet with the alumni. In the Perkins days, we had signed a contract with a small jet charter service for some considerable mileage, and we used a remaining piece of that mileage for my return to Ithaca. I don't remember what time I arrived in Ithaca, but I do remember a night with very little sleep. We obtained a court-granted restraining order and served it on the occupying students early in the sit-in. We had considered this option earlier, but had been reluctant to use it. The students were certain to defy the order, and they would be in contempt of court. The court was likely to enforce the order using local law enforcement agencies, which was just what we did not want. In earlier protests, we had instituted twice daily radio broadcasts by me, telling the community what was happening on the campus. In this case, we began those broadcasts that day, the second day of the occupation, and I made myself as visible as possible on the campus to make sure people knew I was at home and on the job. In the course of the evening, I spoke to the Tucson alumni by a telephone hookup. During the evening, the protesters demanded a discussion about Cornell's complicity in the Vietnam War. The terms for that discussion were negotiated by some of the executive staff, and I agreed to participate. By the time I entered the building, it was about 2 a.m. A first-year law student was an active participant in resolving protest issues that year, and he was much concerned about my personal safety, something I was never worried about. I never felt any personal insecurity in all the 11 protest years. The law student never left my elbow, however. The discussion by a panel that included university officials and protesting SDS students seemed like a reasonable one to me. I was able to respond in what I thought was a responsible way, in spite of almost no sleep for 48 hours. I was treated with respect by the students, and the only verbal abuse I experienced was at the hands of a faculty wife who was in the crowd. I was back in my office early that morning, and I made the morning radio report. I began to think about the speaking commitment in Tucson that evening, and the more I thought about it, the more I was determined to keep it. We arranged a charter jet to Chicago, leaving Ithaca at 11 a.m., a commercial flight to Tucson, and a charter back to Ithaca. I recorded the afternoon broadcast and then left town at 11 a.m. I arrived in Tucson about 6 p.m., was met by my family, changed into my black tie outfit at my son's house, went to the designated place at the designated time, had dinner, gave my talk, and went to the airport for the charter flight back to Ithaca, where I arrived around 6 a.m. I was back in my office by 8 o'clock, and no one other than my immediate office staff knew I had been away. It was a gorgeous spring Saturday, and students were streaming up the hill past Carpenter Hall to attend the day's athletic events, a medieval fair, and other campus activities. The protesters tried to attract the attention of the passing crowds, but to no avail. There was one noteworthy bit. A well-known law professor was tired of hearing the harangue over the outdoor public address system, and he came along with a pair of wire cutters and cut the wires to the loudspeakers. By Monday, after 5 days, everyone was tired of the disruption of campus life, and the protesters declared victory, left the building, and marched up East Avenue past the administration building. One of the vice presidents, who was always close to any protesting students, was standing in front of Day Hall as the marchers passed. A young woman, who was one of the organizers of the protest, saw her administrative friend, left the march to embrace him, and say to him, "I guess we lost that one." Administrators and protesters alike are human beings. One of the problems with the injunction process was the difficulty in positive identification of people defying the order. In this case, the campus police equipped themselves with cameras and attempted to photograph the students, but the students smeared the camera lenses with peanut butter. About 10 students and one faculty member out of perhaps 100 people occupying the library were identified and served 2 weeks each in jail. The SDS president was brought before the city judge on some other charge and was sentenced to the same 2 weeks. After the judge pronounced the sentence, the student replied angrily, "Why don't you make it a month?" The judge banged his gavel down and said, "A month it is." There was a much publicized sit-in at the University of Chicago where the students occupied a building with the main entrance apparently the only access point. The students were in the building several days, and faculty members entered the building and identified everyone. When the students came out, the police apprehended all of them as they left the building and booked them all on the appropriate charges. Cornell faculty would never participate in the identification process. The protest intensity diminished in the mid-70s, although there were still some major disruptions. The final event was an occupation of my office in April 1976 by a group of black students protesting the dismissal of a black employee whom I mentioned earlier. I went directly from my office to the university lawyers, and we started the restraining order procedure, a procedure that had been perfected by that time. The local Supreme Court judge was hearing a case in Elmira. I called him there. He came out of the courtroom to talk to me, told me where he would be at 7 p.m., and we delivered the requisite papers to him. He signed them, and the order was served. The students were being advised by a black law student who told them that they would be in serious trouble if they defied the order. The sit-in ended shortly after midnight. In all the major protest events, we decided at the beginning of the event how we were going to conduct ourselves. The executive staff met to define our operating principles. No outside police, nobody gets hurt, no amnesty for anyone, willingness to discuss issues but not while building occupation and progress, etc. I carried that list in my pocket throughout the event, and we discussed it with the campus police. We were always close to the police, and they were a fine group of human beings. There were many nights when I spent part of the night in the police headquarters in Barton Hall. We always had alternate command posts in various buildings around the campus. Telephones were always in place and operational, and there was a stock of necessary supplies. In the Willard Strait takeover, the alternate site was the law school dean's office, and we operated from there with the president in charge. In the Carpenter Hall occupation, I believe we never used the alternate site. We stayed right in the president and provost offices. In crisis times, we reserved a room in the Statler to provide a place for people to get some sleep, which was often badly needed. In those protest times of the 60s and early 70s, there was a group of students who helped resolve issues, sometimes from an elected position in campus governance, or simply because they wanted to be involved. One of the most effective ones was the law student who played a significant role in the Carpenter Hall occupation. Another was an undergraduate named Stephen Hadley, now the National Security Advisor in the Bush administration. One feature of the protests I never understood was the prevalence of foul language and obscenities. Every protest group seemed to have a coterie of loudmouth participants whose mission was to address me by every foul word or phrase I had ever heard, and some I had never heard of before. Somehow, it was a badge of membership in the protest culture to outdo the next person in the use of foul language. We lived on South Hill, and I usually drove to work down Hudson and Aurora streets to Buffalo and then up the hill to the campus. There were almost always students hitching rides up the hill, and I often stopped to pick them up. One regular was an SDS leader whom I knew, and I gave him rides several times. We debated the issues of the day in a friendly manner on the way up the hill. One day, I picked up a student I did not know, but recognized as a participant in some unhappy event the day before. I asked him whether he thought such affairs really promoted the cause, whatever the cause was on that occasion. We had a reasonable discussion of the question, and it was clear he did not know to whom he was talking. We pulled into my parking place behind the administration building, and he suddenly realized who I was. He said, "Jesus Christ." Got out of the car, slammed the door, and walked away without looking back. What was the impact of the protests? Did they change anything? The protests about the Vietnam War and the marches on Washington certainly had an influence on ending the war. I doubt that the university protests added much to the success of the civil rights movement when compared to the work of Martin Luther King and the determination of Rosa Parks and other like-minded people. On many issues, I was on the side of the students, but I had trouble seeing what occupying my office did to influence American foreign policy in Southeast Asia. On the other hand, if people do not work to right what they see as injustice when they're young and have more idealism and more energy than they will ever have again, God help us when they are old. Thank you. I will try to answer any questions you have.
Dale, Barth and I were on campus at this time. One thing you haven't mentioned that was a crisis for the faculty and the campus was at the time of the Willard Strait takeover, Barton Hall was seized overnight and students came running by the thousands, and the next day there was a very significant faculty vote. Would you be willing to comment?
Yes, I didn't talk about it at all, and there are about 100 other things I didn't talk about. The crisis on the Sunday of the Strait takeover, the guns had started coming in Saturday night. What to do about it, how to get the students out of the Strait without their guns, was a very major issue. Keith Kennedy can tell you more about it than I can because he was right there with the students. One of the suggestions of what to do on that day was made by Robert Miller, who was the dean of the faculty, that, let's see, on the Monday, there was a big faculty meeting on Monday. That's what happened then. During that time, that I don't remember the sequence. I remember presiding at faculty meetings with 1,200 people present that lasted 3 hours. And I've never been as tired in my life as I was at the end of some of those. But this is a very complicated story and had involved defiance of the campus judicial system by the black students. And the faculty had voted on Monday. The dean had agreed to put before the faculty a motion to rescind some penalties that had been assigned earlier in the defiance of the campus judicial system. And at the same time, there was a big gathering in Barton Hall, thousands of people, which lasted all week, at least lasted for a week, Monday through Saturday. And at that meeting, everybody harangued everybody else. Black students talked, SDS talked, President Perkins talked. I finally talked at the end, pleading with them to, we've done this long enough, let's get back to work. And on Monday evening, the leader of the Strait occupation made a radio speech, which I heard, and telling the community that Cornell had 3 hours to live. I think it's Mike Abrams who has the story about Clint Rossiter crossing the bridge across the gorge here, waiting for a light, and seeing the leader of the black leader, and who came over to greet him in a friendly way, and I think Rossiter wouldn't talk to him. I'll tell the story as I remember it, and the student wouldn't know why, and the professor said, after that speech you made last night, I'm not talking to you. And the student presumably said, Professor, haven't you ever heard black rhetoric before? Is that the story, Mike? The faculty voted again the next day to rescind their former action, which just split the faculty apart. I think I must have presided at that meeting. And that's the one I think with 1,200 people in 3 hours. They were extremely difficult times. The university really didn't operate for the rest of the semester. I had faculty members from arts college departments in my office with tears running down their face. The faculty was split. There was a op-ed piece or a letter to the editor of the New York Times by Milton Konvitz, who was a very distinguished professor in the ILR school, explaining why he changed his vote. And we had a New York Times, a Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times reporter here on the campus representing the Times. And he wrote just some incredibly bad pieces, we thought, about the whole thing. He was very anti-Cornell. And after enough protest, he was withdrawn. And another very well-known Times reporter that we knew and liked was assigned to the campus. And things went much smoother with the press from there on. But there's one interesting story that the students came out of the strait carrying their guns over their shoulders. There'd been negotiation about the guns during the afternoon of that day. And one of the big mistakes I made was not going to the scene and talking to the students myself. It was always a question of whether you could do any useful talking with a group of students who were as angry as those students were and frightened at that point. They knew me, and I think they trusted me. And had I gone there, I might have been able to make a difference. The difference would have been leave the guns behind when you come out. And I'd had conversation with the authorities downtown about that, just that issue earlier in the afternoon. But they came out with their guns, and some of them had bandoliers of ammunition all across their chests, and the press and the photographers were all standing out in front. Our photographer, Saul Goldberg, was standing beside an AP photographer from Albany, and at the critical moment, or just before the critical moment when the students came out, the AP photographer ran out of film, suddenly realized he didn't have any film. And Saul said, oh, here, take one roll of my film. So he loaded up his camera real quick. The students came out. Saul and the AP professor took the same picture. The AP professor won the Pulitzer, or AP photographer won the Pulitzer Prize. But that picture was on every newspaper, the front page of every newspaper in the country, and if it hadn't been for that picture, Cornell would never have been heard of in the trouble, the civil rights troubles, I think. And it's always been a bad thing in back of my mind, what else could I have done to have prevented those guns from coming out? But I don't know, that doesn't answer your question, Martha.
That's what I wanted to report it, what happened.
Well, the Barton Hall melee broke up after a week. Some faculty members held classes after that, some didn't. It was chaos.
President Carson, I don't think you were the wrong man in the wrong place at the wrong time. I think you were the right man in the right place at the right time. And we think Cornell and Kendall owe you a tremendous bit of gratitude. Thank you, and thank you for the talk.